It's WrestlePod, the Troopany Show, with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show, and there you hear the subtle stylings of the Crush Gals, today's subject, as well as some other people. And to join me in this review of, well, not J-pop from the 1980s, but something similar, is Mr. Marcus Green, the TNA resident TNA expert of WrestleTalk TV. How are you, sir?
I'm good, just jamming out.
Is this your groove, sir?
It may very well be by the time I'm done with it. Should you send me more videos?
And also to help us out today, I have Miss Chelsea Spollen, who I have no doubt has grooved down to this many times.
there's a little bit of bopping in my seat right now going on. Yeah. I'm not gonna lie.
Okay, if you haven't guessed already, we're talking about the Crush Girls. I did talk about that earlier. But the Crush Girls were also massive pop stars in Japan, as well as being massive wrestling stars. So we're going to talk a little bit about Japanese popular culture. We're going to talk a lot about Joshi and the growth of Joshi in the 1980s, because today it's all about All Japan, and it's all about All Japan women. So we'll be back right after this break.
WrestlePlus.com is the brand new home of incredible online wrestling content, featuring uncensored shoot interview classics, full series of WrestleTalk TV and British Wrestling Weekly, exclusive documentaries, British wrestling's biggest names before they were stars, an incredible podcast collection, up to 90% off merchandise offers, and the brand new Power Slammed e-magazine forwarded by Finn Martin himself. WrestlePlus has thousands of hours of content with new and exclusive releases added regularly. You can join today for the stupidly low price of just £4.99 a month. Wrestle Plus, because this is wrestling.
Welcome back. So, All Japan Women, Chelsea, you have been so looking forward to doing this bit. Why is All Japan in the 1980s one of your favorite subjects?
Because basically every female star from that era who is of note is just completely incredible and belongs in the history books as one of the best of all time. Like, so many of these ladies are just so amazing and did so much for wrestling and are just incomparable.
There you go. That sums that up with about as definitive as you can. Marcus, what's your impression of this particular area of All Japan Women? And, you know, again, coming in at it as an outsider who's not watched too much of it, what do you think of it?
Just coming off what we just was talking about with Jumbo and Tenryu, I mean, just, you know, for the women, I think, to succeed to the level that they did in this time, it spoke even more volumes to just, you know, the people that they were individually, because I do think it was a little bit more dense and, you know, the hurdles were a little bit higher to jump over. So, you know, these women not only proved that the level of toughness, but, you know, achieved a level of success that rivaled the many times. So it just, you know, it speaks volumes to that culture and, you know, just, you know, the level of competition that it bred and really the, you know, the performance that it would essentially create, because these were, you know, women who very much, you know, thrived in this for a period of time and kind of, you know, went back to regular life. But at a time, you know, when they were at, you know, the height of their success in wrestling, they were kind of like these super athletes almost. So, and to be a pop star at the same time is insane. So, just, you know, it just, again, the legitimacy of these stars always sticks out to me.
Yeah, I mean, last time we talked about All Japan Women, we kind of got up to the point where Jagger Yokota was the star of the company. And we talked a little bit about Lioness Asuka being kind of her equal or on a same kind of playing field when it came to ability as Jagger Yokota. Now, we're going to take a couple of steps back, because the Crush Gals, or Chigusa Nagayo and Lioness Asuka, as their real, well, their ring names, not their actual real names, their individual ring names, started in 1980. Now, they came hot on the heels of the Lovely Angels, the prototypical All Japan Women tag team, you know, the beauty pair. These guys were the ones that really propelled All Japan forward into the consciousness of Japanese wrestling fans, and specifically teenage girls. And that's really important to remember, because when we talk about All Japan women in the 1990s and in the late 80s, it's a very different dynamic, a very different audience dynamic than what we're speaking about today. Now, we also talked about the beauty pair being pop stars as well, but that consciousness, that popularity of the beauty pair and Jackie Sato individually meant that the popularity of Joshi had grown. And it's a very kind of exponential learning curve for Joshi, because they started off with no TV coverage, and then, you know, all being family members of the Matsunagas, or married to a Matsunaga brother, or a daughter or a sister or a cousin of a Matsunaga brother. And that first wave very quickly brings more people into the dojo, and then the next wave brings the beauty pair into the dojo, and they bring in even more people into the dojo. So all these people that want to be wrestlers, that have the drive, that have the athletic ability, the Matsunaga brothers get to pick the cream of the absolute crop of these wrestlers. And as we go through the 80s, it's a pattern that repeats itself, to the point where you're talking about when me and Chelsea did the Dream Slam review, you know, people like Megumi Kudo weren't good enough to be All Japan pro wrestlers, which is just insane. But we'll get to that in a few episodes' time. This is my favorite phrase at the moment. So in this particular point in the 1980s, we've got these two wrestlers, Chigusa Nagayo and Linus Asuka. The Matsunaga brothers almost instantly see great things in them. Chelsea, what do they see in these two people who are short-haired, athletic-looking girls next door?
So the girls next door appeal is definitely important, because teenage girls looking at them feel like they're relatable, but they also get that like power fantasy of like, oh my God, these women can do amazing things. And, you know, look at how strong and tough they are, but they look just like me. I could cut my hair that same way and dress like that. Also, I think, especially I feel like with these two, with Chigusa Nagayo and Linus Asuka in particular, there's so much charisma there. Like I never feel bored watching a match of theirs. Like you can't. They are so electric right away. I feel like Chigusa Nagayo stands out as just somebody who is really, really tough. And it's really interesting, very early in her career, you know, they gave her sort of like these sweetheart haircuts and tried to sort of, I think, make her look as feminine as possible. And then towards like the later you get in her career, she cuts her hair really short. She cuts the sleeves off her t-shirts. Like she starts dressing more like the way the guys dressed at the time. Like she just, there's no pretense about her trying to make her be as like feminine and demure as possible. You can't hold her down. She's Chigusa Nagayo. She will not be denied. And Lioness Asuka is, I'm trying to think of her defining qualities. Like she just has that, I think probably she has that magnetism in a way that maybe Chigusa stands out because of the things she does. But like Lioness Asuka is somebody who like walks in a room and people take notice of her. Like she's just, even when at the beginning of her career, when she's this little super tiny, you know, 90 pound soaking wet Japanese girl, she's got such a presence around her at all times.
Here's a thought. Do you think that's the influence of Riki Chosu? Because Lioness Asuka takes the Scorpion Deathlock as her submission finisher. And there are certain elements of Chosu that I see in Asuka. You know, that presence you're talking about, let the wrestling do the talking. You know, she just right. looks that magnetism that Chosu had. You know, is there a connection there, do you think?
So, stylistically, I definitely agree that there's a connection there. But also, I do think that some of that X factor is something that can't be taught. I think you either have some of those qualities or you don't. And I feel like part of what gives her that magnetism is her determination, which is something that they can't teach you. Like, you have to really want it to, in wrestling, to be able to come across like that. And, you know, it's something like you see it in modern day stars all the time, or really any era. You watch some wrestlers who are perfectly technically capable and athletically capable, but they just don't have that X factor that makes them into TV stars. And Lioness Asuka, I don't think anybody had to teach her how to be captivating. You know, maybe Choshu had to teach her how to move the right way, you know, and certain things about like how to interest the crowd. But I don't think anybody had to teach her how to get your attention. I think she just knew.
So, Marcus, you've been doing your Crush Girls homework this week. What did you think of them as in-ring workers?
I thought it was, I mean, is hard-hitting as any of the guys, certainly. I mean, in terms of, I mean, the in-ring work, I think, speaks for itself. But definitely, I'm always a big guy that paid attention, you know, even now to, you know, presentation and echo Chelsea's, you know, sentiments. You know, just that, you know, kind of girl next door appeal with, you know, with the short hair and, you know, specifically with Lioness Oscar, who just, like Chelsea said, she just has this intimidating look. Like, she looked like if she was in a Ninja Turtles movie, like, she'd be, like, the boss over Shredder. Walk in with the leather coat and just, like, I'm not to be messed with at all. So, you know, just, you know, between, you know, presentation, to me, it's half the battle. And then when you get in the in-ring, it's just like, where did you get these women from? It's like, please, can they stay? So it's like, you know, I just think, you know, both of them had kind of that X factor. And when you have, you know, two opposing forces like that, that can create magic going against each other, and you put them together, and it's just, you know, it's really magic. And to have these, you know, kind of promote them as pop stars at the same time just overall gave them a universal appeal that just rivaled any male success during that time. So it's just kind of been real awe-inspiring to kind of watch some of these videos.
Yeah, just to give you an idea of that, like, that killer attitude that Lioness Asuka, just her list of finish maneuvers on Wikipedia: the K-driller, the reverse pile driver, the maneuver that broke Masahiro Chono's neck and Steve Austin's neck, the LSD-2, the leg hook sit-out suplex slam, the LSD-3, the cutthroat leg hook sit-out suplex slam, possibly one of the best wrestling move names ever, the tower hacker bomb, the backbreaker rack dropped into a sit-out power bomb. This is not stuff that, you know, this is serious wrestling stuff. This is a moveset that's just, like, insane. And it developed against some of the toughest opponents in pro wrestling history. We need to talk about them. Gokaku Dome. Did I get the pronunciation right, Chelsea?
Yeah.
Yay! The Atrocious Alliance, which was led by the incomparable, the wonderful, the insane Dump Matsumoto, alongside Crane Yu, Kondo Saito, and Bull Nakano. They were the ones that were the driving force against the Crush Girls, because, you know, every Midnight Express needs its Rock and Roll Express, and every Legion of Doom needs its Demolition. And the women they're wrestling are just insane heels. You know, the tag team of Bull Nakano and Dump Matsumoto is about the scariest wrestling tag team I've ever seen, even now. You watch back to those matches from the 80s, and Dump Matsumoto literally wrestles like a woman possessed. I've never seen anyone be so angry.
Oh my god, it's insane.
Yeah, she's genuinely driven to hurt these people, which sounds overly dramatic, but it's true. You know, we can't give the Crush Girls' athletic ability justice. Dump Matsumoto's heel stylings and her ability to be a monster heel are just off the page. You know, she's vicious, she's vile, she cheats at every opportunity, she has this magnetism that just makes you want to hate her. She has all of these attributes, and she's the right sized person. She's a larger lady, as we say, but, you know, that doesn't slow her down. She's still incredibly athletic for her size. Marcus, what did you think about Dump Matsumoto and this entire heel stable that just seems to never give in, and they are just like the ultimate heels as far as AJW fans were concerned in the 1980s?
Yeah, well, I mean, if I was a fan watching that time, I might be a little just scared, because like you said, it was just, you know, this almost felt like a controlled chaos, but very much, you know, again, the word intimidating comes to mind, because, you know, not only was it, you know, very chaotic and, you know, seems frantic at times, but the accuracy in which they do a lot of these strikes, like, you know, even today, as I watch somebody like Asuka, who, you know, has a certain level of intimidation with her, specifically when she's smiling. So, you know, but, you know, when she gets in that ring and she just turns it up, and you, like, she's really like this, you know, to me, she's like a rainbow-haired assassin almost when she gets in that ring. And I think a lot of that, you know, just a trickle down effect from what we got from these ladies, specifically this heel faction, who, you know, like you said, you kind of have to turn it up to a different level, specifically just, you know, not just because they're women, but, you know, you have to be to take it to a new level of hatred when you go up against like the Crush Girls, who just have this overwhelming swarm of success. So, you know, it's just, again, it's kind of, because I'm not as familiar, it's kind of jarring at times just because of that, but it's not any less inspiring in the least.
Chelsea, what's your thoughts on Dump Matsumoto? What makes her tick and what makes her a great heel?
I love Dump Matsumoto because she scares the bejesus out of you like half the time. You're always afraid she's going to hurt somebody or kill somebody. And, you know, half the time it looks like she is killing somebody in front of you. And she's the most ostentatious wrestler I've ever seen, like bar none. She knows exactly how to push your buttons. It just comes naturally to her. And I have no idea what she's like outside of her in-ring persona. I know very, very little about her personal life partly because I don't want to. I don't know that I want anything to challenge that image that I have of her that's just so much larger than life. Like, she's spectacular as a heel because she is the antithesis of all the things that made the Crush Gals popular, but she's still on their level as a wrestler. Like, it's not just her personality that makes her great. It's also her athletic skill and her ability to execute, you know, all these amazing things that are sort of unthinkable sometimes. But at the same time, she's a bigger girl at a time when that was really not considered to be, by Japanese beauty standards at the time, that wasn't considered to be favorable. She has these amazing ugly haircuts and spectacularly creepy makeup, and she just doesn't care. Like, and the fact that she doesn't care how much she offends you is part of what makes her great.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And excuse my language, the beep machine's coming out again, but she just doesn't give a fuck. And I've never come across a wrestler that gives less of a fuck than she does. You know, I've never come across Jake Roberts at his most heelish, still wanting to get things done within the realms of a wrestling match. You know, yeah. You look at the great heels of all time, Flair bent the rules and cheated his way through, but it was always like within the realms of a wrestling match. And even Abdullah and the Sheik, their intent was to win the wrestling match. And I'm not sure that Dump Matsumoto wanted to win the wrestling match. She just wanted to hurt the other person that was in front of her. You know,
I don't even know if it's just that she wanted to hurt the other person that was in front of her, though, because I think if her only goal was to hurt people, she probably would have just beaten people to death and that would have been the end of it. She would have had a very short career. And I think I have to imagine, again, I know very little about her personal life, but I have to imagine that it must have been some kind of genuine outlet for things she was actually thinking and feeling to behave that way, because it's so genuine. Even when she is doing, you know, like a move that's technically speaking like a rest hold or doing something that protects her opponent more, it still looks so brutal because I feel like the emotion behind it is real.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, it's even now, even today, I mean, I watched a Dump Matsumoto match. The last match I saw her in, well, I saw her on a Marvelous card of all places. She was doing shows there, and she just, that wasn't probably the best example because it was a house show and it wasn't as involved. But there was a Sendai Girls tournament. I think it was in 2011. I'm just looking here to see who she was against. And she's like 52 at the time. And she's in this match. And she's the first leg of the tournament for the veterans. Okay, so she's the one opening. She was the special surprise. Right. And she lays into her opponent in such a savagely vicious way. I have never seen anything like it. You know, even I was familiar with Matsumoto. I'm familiar with her work. I knew what she was like. But even then, it was just shocking. And it's just so violent, and just so she pulls out some scissors from her tights and just goes, lays into her opponent, and it's like, what are you doing?
It's very much a form of just looking at some of the stuff now. It's very much a form of emotional and psychological warfare that she imbued, because like you said, even with the rest holds, it's like it almost looked like a form of torture at times, because of course she would do all these things, especially in tag matches, while looking at the partner of said victim. And you got to believe that even the person taking this stuff was like, what the hell are you doing to me right now? So, you know, very much a constant form of intimidation with every single move that she did. Like, it looked like she was writing something on opponent's head and then stabbing them, and then writing something else and then stabbing them. It was very unorthodox. But again, like Joseph said, it went with her whole appeal. Like, she, you know, she looked different. She moved different. She was just one scary lady. So just she had intimidation factor down to a key, a science almost.
Now Gekki Dome begin their dominance of tag team wrestling with Crane Yu to begin with, and then when Crane Yu goes into the background, she picks up a new protege in Bull Nakano. Now, Bull Nakano in the 1980s was a slightly different animal to the Bull Nakano we would come to know and love in the early 90s. But this was a very important part of her career, because she's learning from the absolute mistress of heeldom in Dump Matsumoto. And this really puts a whole spin on her career and sets her up phenomenally well to be the top draw for All Japan Women in the 1980s. I think we have to talk about Bull Nakano at this point. Bull Nakano, 16 years old, I think, in 1981 when she made a debut. I'm not sure exactly. I will just check.
It says debut 1983. Yeah, Wikipedia.
Yeah, she was debuted in 1983, but it says 84 actually in the text. So, she must have been 15 years old when she made a debut.
My God.
Yeah, she was 15 years old when she made a debut in 1983. 15 years old in one of the biggest wrestling promotions in the world when she made a debut, and she was already AJW champion at 16. In 1984. So essentially she had a 5-year run at the top of the card in the biggest faction in All Japan Women, learning her trade to be the number one person in the company. And she was wrestling the number one and number two draws for 5 years, essentially. This is something else when you kind of like realize how good she got. But what's your thoughts on Nakano in this particular time period, Chelsea?
So I'm trying to think of how to properly distinguish her. Bull Nakano is every bit as good a heel as Dump Matsumoto. I think the thing that gets her over and sort of like distinguishes her brand a little bit more is that she's more technical, and there's something a little bit prettier about the way she wrestles, which that sounds like a contradiction to her being such a good heel, but I actually think it makes the heel work better.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you're scared for her opponents because she's so good. Like, was the one she used to do, the Bull's Poseidon, the back to belly pile driver.
Yeah.
Like, how do you watch that and not think, oh my God, somebody's gonna die? Like, she was just so good and so athletically capable, and she just pushed herself so hard. Like, I think that's another thing that all the women in this era have in common, is you can tell they all just push themselves so hard to be the best. And Bull Nakano is definitely somebody who that stands out as one of her defining qualities for sure.
Marcus, were you more familiar with the Bull Nakano of the 1990s from WCW and WWE, or did you know, what were your impressions from watching that person then watching the younger person?
I'm more familiar with the 90s version, but I mean, I'm not really surprised even when you said how young she was, because, you know, looking at some of the instances with that, even with that match you know, we had with the young girl and Kenny Omega, is like these performers start out young anyway. Like, yeah. Because I feel like she put on a fantastic match, and I'm like, okay, she's going to be special if she ever wants to do this full time. But, yeah, I mean, just, you know, again, what sticks out to me most of all is just the intimidation factor. I mean, from the hair, the makeup, I mean, she had a size about her. But, you know, like Chelsea said, there was a certain style to her that was a little bit had a bit more pizzazz to it than Dump did. But at the same time, it was just as vicious. It was just as violent. And if she, you know, if she was the same way when she was, you know, younger, as I'm not too familiar with, it was just, you know, it just shows that, you know, these women, like Chelsea said, pushed each other to the limit. But at the same time that they evolved, kind of like the men did, which, you know, all performers need to do. But at the same time, never letting off that intimidation factor, specifically with these women's, you know, insane move sets that probably, you know, rival if not go past the men. So,
yeah, it's really interesting because there's many different layers to the Crush Girls era. You know, on the one hand, as we've just talked about, these are phenomenal athletes. They are doing things in the wrestling ring that no one has even tried before. They're incredibly tough. They're amazing brawlers. They're technically adept. And then on top of all that, as we talked about right at the top of the show, the Crush Girls had several top 10 pop singles hits in Japan. You know, and you know, and even to this day, it's something Chigusa Nagayo is very proud of. If you watch Marvelous Shows, which is Chigusa Nagayo's own promotion that she runs now, quite often on house shows, she'll be leading the house band and the band will play everyone's introductions.
It's amazing.
You know, because she's a very good singer. She's very adept at what she wants. She wants to continue singing and she wants to continue wrestling, even though she's in her 50s. And she's the boss and she's the biggest women's wrestling draw of all time. So I'm not going to argue with her. She clearly knows what she's doing. We talked about the music, Chelsea, in the first episode. Is there anything different you want to say about the Crush Girls and their pop sensation, or at least the audience participation of that?
That's interesting. I think it's really amazing that the Japanese women wrestlers who were really successful in this era were also packaged as like idols and pop stars, because I think of that as being something that not just is very uniquely Japanese, but also that wrestling has kind of lost in the modern era now. Like, wrestlers are not really able to be mainstream celebrities the same way that they were in this time period. And it's really incredible to me that the Crush Girls, which I think of as being such like a, I think of it as such of a niche art form, right? Because in the modern era, it is. Like, wrestling is not something that everybody is into. You know, most of us who like wrestling, we have like two or three friends outside of the internet who really like wrestling, if we're lucky, and that's it. And everybody else is just kind of like, why are you talking about this at the dinner table? And, and you know, in that time, when the Crush Girls were at their peak, you could buy their pop single, you could, you know, hear it on the radio, you could put posters of them up in your room because they were for sale, you could dress like them. Like, that's just kind of mind-blowing to me that they were so big and also possibly so influential to, you know, many of the teenage girls who bought tickets to those shows and looked up to them and aspired to be them.
So many teenage girls buying tickets to those shows. They are so, Marcus, you back me up on this. What's the AJW crowd like in this time period, from what you've heard this week when you've been watching these matches?
Just involved, very much involved and invested, like Joseph said, in these women, you know, talking about, you know, these teenage girls who, I mean, a lot of times, I mean, obviously, I think a lot of these girls got kind of basically converted into wrestling fans, just because, I mean, you become such a huge fan of someone, you kind of get into everything, all aspects of their life. So when, you know, you come to these shows because, you know, you're a huge fan of these women's music and you see them in the ring, it's like, oh my God, it's like, you know, not only can they, you know, put out fantastic music, but they, you know, knocking people's blocks off. And then, you know, for a lot of people who aren't necessarily into that stuff, it just shows again, you know, like Chelsea alluded to earlier, that X factor, you know, and it's so smart of Tekashi to kind of capitalize off that. Like, you know, specifically for me watching, you know, the mainstream wrestling today, a lot of these guys have to kind of succeed outside of the business in spite of, you know, what they do in the ring, because they're not really allowed, like Chelsea said, to go mainstream. And a lot of times places like WWE won't even try to capitalize off it unless it's somebody like The Rock or, you know, outside forces, because they can't, a lot of times, don't even get they alleged main stars over. But, you know, I just think in terms of the Crush Gals, I mean, one thing, the legitimacy was there in terms of the in-ring and everything they can do in the ring. It spoke for itself. But I think music is just universal anyway. So, you know, when you put all those elements, you know, together, I just, you know, think the crowds that they were drawing, you know, 1,000 of, you know, 4,000 fans for regular shows and everything, I just think it was just smart business.
Yeah, you know, teenage girls, especially in the post-war period, have money to spend. You know, it's a smart market to it's a smart market to sell to, because teenage girls eventually turn into women who have kids, who buy more stuff, who buy records and buy wrestling tickets. And this continuing rolling development of AJW in this time period, because the 26 rule is still in place, you've got a short window to make as much money out of these people as you can. And AJW worked that really, really well, you know. And the actual appeal of the draw, just to give you the idea of numbers, Goku Dome versus the Crush Girls as a feud was regularly getting 12.0 viewing figures for Fuji TV. That's four times what Raw does now. You know,
it's incredible.
Yeah, it was fascinating, and the production values were absolutely top notch. It was the best looking wrestling show in the world at the time. You had double camera, you had double hard cam, so you could do reverse shots from either side. You had two people doing handheld shots. They were doing close ups. They were presenting it really well. They had four-way commentary teams who never trod on each other's toes. You can listen to the commentary on AJW shows, and it's like music. Everything fits together. It's so beautifully well done. It's so beautifully presented. Those shows, even from the late 1970s and early 1980s, stand up so well now compared to production now. You know, they don't have the big ring entrances, but they were doing, you know, vignettes, and they were doing breakaway stuff. They were doing storyline projections with, you know, I can remember Goke Dome doing a training session one day to show how they were going to defeat the Crush Girls. They were doing all sorts of things. Plus, they were doing the regular Japanese promotion stuff like press conferences before shows. And, you know, it was a really well presented, well put together show. And even the quality of the show, if you go look at an All Japan Women's show on YouTube from 1981, it looks really, really good because they had the best video cameras to shoot it with, because Sony were next door making the best video cameras in the world. You know,
oh, I never thought about that.
Yeah, everything's in the right place. They're in the right place to make the best wrestling product ever made with the best wrestlers they could possibly find who are willing to go that extra mile to, because they know they have this short window of success. We've got 10 years and we have to make this 10 years count. And I think that's one of the driving forces that makes this product so special. Now, the big feud, obviously, is between these two tag teams. And it starts in around about 1985 on and off. And it really goes hell for leather until 1986, when Matsumoto wrestles Chigusa Nagayo in a hair versus hair match. And Nagayo loses. And it is just the sound of young women screaming. Screaming is the only way.
It's almost devastating.
Yeah, it is literally just, you can feel their hearts breaking. This is how deep this storyline is. How would you describe it, Chelsea? Because I'm lost for words to describe it any better than that.
Oh man, it's hard to tell, first of all, who the crowd cares about more, because it feels like the crowd cares about everybody so much. Like, there's nobody they don't care about. So then seeing Chigusa Nagayo like lose like that, and it's I feel like the audience is partly screaming because they're devastated, and I also feel like they're partly screaming just because of the epicness of the moment. Like, it's I'm at a loss for words too. It's really, really, you just have to watch it. Like,
yes, here, you watch this, you watch. Yes. Yeah, you should do, because, and you should also watch the rematch, which is even more phenomenally off the charts. It loses something actually when you watch the first one, because the fans are so emotionally invested. But when Chigusaw gets the win back in another street fight, and another, I'm sure it's another hair versus hair match, and it is, by all accounts, it should be a horrible match. It's an interference-led mess. Gokoki Dome interfere at every opportunity. At one point, they just beat the referee up because they figure, well, it's a no DQ match. What, he can't DQ me, so therefore, I'll just beat him up instead. And then the referee manages to get back to his feet and finishes the match out. But the referee's bleeding in that match. And the crowd is just going absolutely crazy. And when Nagayo finally wins, it the place goes unhinged. You have never seen a wrestling crowd respond like it. I just can't describe it. You do have to watch these matches. Just because they're... As much as we talk about Manami Toyota and the next generation of All Japan being the best wrestlers ever, and they are... The actual level of emotional involvement, because, and this I'm not meaning to sound sexist, but teenage girls are emotional beings. They run on emotion a lot of the time, and they get so invested in this and so into this. And the crowd reactions in this time period are just phenomenal, aren't they?
It's amazing. And I wish that it was easier to find fan accounts from people who had been at those matches in person in English. I know they exist in Japanese, but my Japanese is nowhere near good enough to be able to understand them correctly. But I mean, I can only imagine what that must have been like to be in the arena and see some of these matches, because it's just, it's so emotional and it's so intense just watching it on my computer.
Marcus, what did you think of these particular matches in this particular time period?
I mean, again, I just think it's, you know, I like the perfect storm, like I said, with them being able to capitalize off that teenage fan base. It was huge, you know, for the popularity of the Crush Girls specifically. I mean, when you talk about just that reaction alone, I mean, we see it today where, you know, these celebrities have these, you know, almost like they're fans of this faction. This insane faction, and if you know, especially on social media, where, you know, huge stars like Rihanna, Beyonce have, you know, legions of fans called the Beehive and the Navy, and if, you know, you say anything discouraging about them, the Legion comes for you and basically sends you death threats. So, you know, when you talk about, you know, that moment where she lost and the fans going nuts, you know, these teenage girls get so invested, it's almost like what happens to them happens to them in the audience. So, you know, and no one wants to get their hair cut off, specifically, you know, a teenage girl, I would definitely expect. So, you know, I just think those Japan crowds are always, you know, always spectacular to watch, just in terms of, you know, the build up towards, you know, the finish. But man, that tension in that audience, specifically with those, you know, young women, just only added to the match, and, you know, for them to get invested into, you know, Nagayo like they did. And, you know, just because, like you said, the match itself, you know, specifically the rematch with all the interference and everything to do with that, it's just sometimes it can become a cluster. But I think the investment is what really was the foundation. So, you know, no matter what happened, they was just fully behind her and everything she did. So, you know, I just think it's a credit to the booking overall.
Now, when you look at this feud essentially lasted from August 25th, 1984 until August 23rd, 1986. This is a 2-year feud. And it has singles matches, it has tag team matches, and it has a feud with other people in the same kind of era as well. The Crush Girls win the championships from the Dynamite Girls in 1984. They then lose them to Dump Matsumoto and Crane Yu in 1985. They win them back a couple of months later. Then they have to vacate the championships when Chigusaw Nagayo is injured. And then the Jumping Bomb Angels take the championships from Bull Nakano and Kondo Sato in January of 86. The Crush Girls win them back in March of 86. And then they eventually lose them to Dump Matsumoto and Bull Nakano. Linus Asuka was actually injured in that match, and Kazu Nakaore substituted for her. So they never actually beat the Crush Girls fair and square for the championships as Dump Matsumoto and Bull Nakano. But then again, neither Bull Nakano didn't, you know, lose the championships either. There's an awful lot of protection and layers going on here. But I think it's about time we talked about the Jumping Bomb Angels as well, because they were incredibly important to this story. And the other thing we need to talk about in this particular time period, The Jumping Bunny Angels were kind of a swing back to the beauty pair. They were a tag team that were being sold on their good looks, but also their wrestling ability. And they don't necessarily get talked about in the same breath, but they should do, as the Crush Girls and Gekaki Dome.
It's interesting because, you know, like you said, much like the beauty girls, kind of capitalizing off obviously those looks. But, you know, at the same time, I think with any of these, you know, women that we're going through, the talent, you know, of course is there. But, I mean, I wonder kind of if it was always, you know, the idea to kind of have eventually, you know, always that whole kind of back and forth of, you know, the kind of girl next door versus, you know, this more, you know, like you said, beautiful aesthetic, because, I mean, that works so well. And much like what it did with the beauty pair. But, you know, I don't know how much, you know, that if they still do a lot of that today, but it will certainly created a lot of interest and tension back then.
What do you think of the Jumping Bomb Angels in comparison to these two other teams, Chelsea? Am I right in thinking they're probably not as well revered when they perhaps should be?
They definitely deserve more credit than I think Western fans give them. I think that part of the issue with the Jumping Bomb Angels is that they don't necessarily have the same level of chemistry as a tag team as Nagayo and Lioness Asuka. And that's not to say anything bad about them. Like, that's a really hard dynamic to aspire to. Like, you can't just make that up, you know? I think that the Jumping Bomb Angels were marketed more as, you know, super feminine girl next door model types compared to the way that the Crush Gals were marketed at that time, which is more like serious wrestlers. And that may actually have part that may have impacted how people view their legacy as a team, because the more feminine and female identified something is, the more likely people are to discard it and throw it away and discount it and act like it doesn't matter. They had some great matches with the Crush Gals. Really, any match you find with the Crush Gals and them is worth watching. It's interesting to note. I mean, they hold their own athletically, certainly. I sort of feel like maybe one of the other things that takes away from their notoriety now is that I don't know if either of them really has that, like, X factor. You know what I mean? Like, they're both very photogenic, very pretty girls. They're both very athletic. But I don't know if either of them are, like, natural TV stars.
That's interesting, because when you look at when the next kind of thing I wanted to talk about was all three of these teams ended up in the WWF.
Yeah.
You know, Gekaki Dome went first, and they had a short run. They didn't really get onto Vince McMahon's radar. They were something else to watch, because you can imagine this whirlwind of a tag team that just destroy everything in their path, rolling into, I think, Boston Gardens and just destroying Velvet McIntyre and I think it was Velvet McIntyre and
I watched Dawn Marie Johnson, I know what you're talking about, but yeah. I forget the name of the other girl.
And they just roll in there for a TV show and TV match, and they just destroy the opposition. And it was really bizarre to see two women have such an impressive first, you know, showing. And then the Crush Girls go next. Me and you, Chelsea, have talked about that match they had in Boston Garden before with Gorilla Monsoon on commentary, and Gorilla really takes a shine to Lioness Asuka, and they have a really impressive athletic looking match, but it did look like, not that they were phoning it in, but they didn't look right in that environment. They just didn't look like they were at home. This was not the kind of thing they were going to be good at. Do you know what I mean?
I wonder how much of that was producerial interference, like how much of that was the direction they were given at the time, which I know is less of an issue in that era than it is now. But it really did feel like they were toning it down.
Yeah. And then the Jumping Bomb Angels go, and they get a big run. They're nearly there for a year, you know, and they got to feud over the WWF Women's Tag Team Championships. Yes, there used to be a WWF Women's Tag Team Championship. and, you know, they get to feud over that. And, you know, the story goes that they were due to win the championships at WrestleMania 4, but due to a mix-up and some backstage politicking by our old friend, Fabulous Moolah. They ended up losing. I can't remember. It was Leilani Kai and Velvet McIntyre, wasn't it? Or was it?
I think so.
Yeah, they were the champions, and they ended up dropping the belts to them in Tokyo on an AJW show whilst they were on tour in Japan, apparently under the direction of the Fabulous Moolah, who'd been told that by Pat Patterson, and she had more political clout in the WWE than any other woman, so they listened to her. And then Pat Patterson had to cancel the WrestleMania match because the layout was supposed to be the Jumping Bomb Angels, who were massively popular and incredibly popular in New York. We're going to take the championship at WrestleMania, and if you find there is a Madison Square Garden match where they challenge for the tag team championships, and you look at that presentation, there's Leilani Kai and Velvet McIntyre, who are being managed by Jimmy Hart. You know, their top heel manager is managing the women's tag team championship, and the Jumping Bomb Angels, they come out and they're wearing, I think all these women in this era tended to wrestle in swimsuits because that was the standard thing to wrestle in. Right. But they're wearing Stars and Stripes swimsuits, and when they take their jackets off, there's a massive reaction to that, as you know there would be in that particular time period with that crowd. And the match is really interesting and really intense, maybe not at the same kind of level as you would expect in Japan, but clearly, you know, all of those women had wrestled for AJW at that point. I just find it fascinating that, you know, the Jumping Bomb Angels in that particular era were so over in New York. And it was interesting to me how the fans of that area reacted. And it would really take another 20 years for the WWE to get women's wrestling right as well as they did in that time period.
That's really interesting. You know, I wonder, I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking the Jumping Bomb Angels are more in keeping with the preferred female wrestling aesthetic in the West at that time.
Yeah. The pretty girl who's, you know, not non-threatening is probably the best way of putting it, I guess.
Right. But, and they're non-threatening, but they also manage to be really excellent wrestlers.
Yeah.
that's a hard line to walk, I think.
Yeah, and you know that's maybe another one of the reasons why they do deserve more credit. One thing we can get them credit for is Isuki Yamazaki, one of the Jumping Bomb Angels, actually retired to New York, and she is responsible for the Shikara Joshi Mania tour that occurred in 2011, where a lot of the existing Joshis of this area and modern day Joshi came and wrestled for Shikara. On a three-day tour.
I didn't know she was involved in that. That's so cool.
Yeah, she did. She'd been looking to find a way of getting Joshi to the United States of America for quite a while. She moved to New York, so she's probably not that far away from you. So you can go find her now. I can see you roaming the streets.
Bumped into her on the subway.
Yeah. And she'd moved to New York, and she was looking for a way of getting Joshi into North American pro wrestling. But she wasn't happy with... She didn't want to do it for like someone like TNA or Ring of Honor. She didn't think they were presenting wrestling properly or women's wrestling properly. So she was looking for an environment where it'd be a good place to really tell Joshi stories properly. And then her son is a big Shikara fan. And he showed her DVDs of Shikara and showing, look, this is pretty cool. Look how respectful they are to women. You know, it's intergender, but they have women versus women feuds, and this is such a cool promotion. And she got in contact with Mike Quackenbush, and Quack had already got a deal with Ice Ribbon for early 2011, I think. A couple of the Ice Ribbon girls came over for Shikarasaurus Rex, because there was a couple of new... one of the Takada Inoue, I think, was on that show. But they came over, they did a couple of shows on the same tour as Johnny Saint did his first appearances for Shikara. And then later on in the year, they did the Joshi Mania tour. And that weekend, Shikara, because of the Shikara tour, there were 6 offices in Japan that were closed because they didn't have enough talent to run.
Wow.
You know, and they all came over for Joshi Mania. And the headlining match is Sarah Del Rey versus Aja Kong. I think it was Sarah Del Rey versus Aoki Yamada as well, which was due to be against Meiko Satomura, but Meiko Satomura was injured. So, you know, it was one hell of a tour and some of the best women's wrestling you're ever going to see in North America. And that was Itsuki Yamazaki. That was her wanting to really involve an American company in how to present Joshi properly. And thank you, Jumping Bong Angels, for doing that for us.
It's really amazing, actually, because I know Chikara fans who definitely don't follow Joshi very closely, but talk about that event and matches from that event. So if that was her intent, to help spread the popularity of Joshi to wrestlers in the U.S., it definitely worked. That's amazing.
There you go. We should really kind of wrap up this Crush Girl story, because as we go through the 80s, obviously, Dump Matsumoto, being that little bit older, is getting closer and closer to 26, and she eventually retires, I think, in 1989. And then Bull Nakano, who's obviously a lot younger than all four of these, suddenly starts floating her way up the card, and we'll talk about her separately in another episode about All Japan Women in the 1990s, because she really sets the tone for the 1990s. Mm. But Chigusa Nagaya and Linus Osaka, being of a similar age, head towards their 26th birthdays at around about the same time, and they start feuding over the WWWA Women's Heavyweight Championship. Oh, I thought the WWWF was bad, but I forgot about this one. Now, Jagu Yokota obviously was the star singles wrestler, and she dropped the title in 1985 to retire to go and run the dojo. Devil Masami took over from her as the champion, defeating Dump Matsumoto. And then you have Yukari Amori. And then Chigusa Nagaya wins the championship on a house show in 1987. Linus Asuka wins it from her via forfeit because Nagaya is injured. And they really try and keep each other away from each other for almost a year, really, from between Nagayo's first title win and Linus Asuka finally defeating Nagayo for a vacant championship. This singles title run, which was a face versus face run, it really kind of ended the era of the Crush Girls in such a spectacular way, and really laid up All Japan Women for the next generation by clearing out so many stars from the top of the card. This 26 rule, is it a good thing in the long run for the talent, or is it a bad thing in the long run for the talent? Because I, as much as I agree it's a sexist and misogynistic sentiment, it does do the company good from a business perspective. What are your thoughts on this, Marcus?
About them kind of cutting it out at 26?
I say the 26 rule, the definitive retire at 26 rule, is it good for the business? Because it does clear out people from the main event and you have to have a rotation of talent. Or is it just this old school misogynistic ideal that, you know, is a bit of an archaic thought? What do you think about that? I'll ask you first, because I know Chelsea will have a lot to say about this.
I think it's a bit of both. While it does, you know, like you said, allow you to declare our talent, I think, you know, a lot of times you'll be cutting a lot of these stars off at the knees who have yet to kind of really hit that prime. To say that you can just kind of put these women out the pasture at 26, I think is a little bit, like you said, misogynistic. It's misogynistic, and it's really, you know, taken away from the fans, because I think a lot of these women do have years left in the tank. And obviously, you know, they will be going off to do other things in their life. But, you know, to kind of cut it off at 26, and I know a lot of times, even today, sometimes that's viewed as old, which is absurd to me. But, you know, because I do think these women were extremely durable in every sense of the word. But, yeah, I mean, you do want to create room with the car, but at the same time, you know, we have women like, you know, even today, Gail Kim, who is far past 26, but you know, looks and wrestles like she's in her 20s. It's like,
yeah,
exactly. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a little bit of both. I understand that you know, you want to, you know, create new spots and everything, but I think you can do that, you know, without sending, you know, some of your biggest stars out so early, so soon. So, you know, I think it's a combination of both.
Chelsea, what do you think of this particular paradox of All Japan Women?
I think one of the reasons you're able to have the 26 rule at this time period is that people could start their careers at 15, and that's really no longer the case. It's much less likely now, even in Japan, for that to be able to happen. It is frustrating to me that there are definitely female wrestlers who didn't have an amazing comeback after they retired at 26. It may have helped some of the wrestlers, you know, not do so much damage to their bodies by, you know, overdoing it, that they were able to go on to have happy, healthy lives after the fact. But I also feel like that really denies the women their agency. Like, they should have a choice. I think it's kind of hilarious. Like, we're talking about this in a conversation about the Crush Gals. Like, no one was able to get Chigusa Nagayo or Lioness Asuka to retire. they both did eventually. But, I mean, of course, Chigusa Nagayo went on to found Gaia Japan and to train a lot of really amazing wrestlers after the fact, because she definitely wasn't done yet. And, you know, I wonder, like, It's unlikely for companies now to have a mandatory age rule quite the same way that they did before. But I do wonder about the idea of having a rotation of, you know, like, you're only allowed to be at the top for a certain number of years before we'll either move you down the card or get rid of you altogether or relegate you to, like, a subset of the same promotion, etc. I'm not convinced that that's the worst idea in the world, because... as we all know, as is happening later today at Survivor Series, there are some wrestlers who have been around for a long time who just won't go away to make room for anybody else.
Yeah.
I don't think that was necessarily the foundation of the 26 rule, though. I think the 26 rule was founded on sexist men thinking that when girls were past that point of marriageable age, then they were no longer sexy and attractive and desirable to men, which is freaking hilarious, because women were the ones buying tickets to those events in the first place.
That's true. And I know of Joshi promoters to this day who still think like that. I'd like to point out Chigusa Nagayo, 51 years old, still wrestling.
Still doing it.
Yep, still doing it. Still promoting shows, still having fun. And she rededicated her life to professional wrestling at the very first, well, not the first Marvelous show, but the last independent promoted show she did for Kairi before she went back into promotion full time. She actually went on the house microphone and said, "I'm going to rededicate my life to professional wrestling because quite clearly I don't want to do anything else ever."
Which is a continuing trend, and all the people we've talked about, they've all in some form of way gave back in a lot of ways, but what one of the Crush Girls, like you said, improved it and helped, you know, elevate the women to a level that she herself may have not been able to achieve just because of the blocks that went her way. So
Yeah, and that kind of ends our story of Dekaku Dome and the Crush Girls and the Jumping Bomb Angels. And, you know, we leave this footnote because perhaps the best footnote of this era was Bull Nakano's WWWA World Championship run, which lasted for 1,000 days, well, 1,057, when she took the title from a vacated championship where she beat Misako Nishiwaki in July of 1989, and she held it until Aja Kong defeated her in 1992. But that period of All Japan Pro Wrestling was perhaps the greatest upheaval in AJW, because that's when the next generation laid down their markers for what they would do. And perhaps the greatest generation of pro wrestlers ever were founded, put together into the same roster, and had the greatest professional wrestling matches there's ever been in the next 5-year period. And that will be the subject of another Troopany show, because we've got so much stuff to talk about with that, we cannot do any more justice to it, other than to say, the next time we look at Joshi is the next time we start looking at Manami Toyota, and we start looking at Akira Okuto, and we start looking at Yumiki Hotta, and we start looking at Combat Toyota and Megumi Kudo and QT Suzuki and Dynamite Kansai and Mayumi Ozaki, and wrestling is never as great again as it is in that time period. In my personal opinion, you don't have to agree with me. But, you know, that's what I'm thinking anyway. So we'll wrap that up for today's show on this AJW special edition of the Beginner's Guide to Japan on the Troopany Show. I'd like to thank Mr. Marcus Green. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Pleasure as always. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
And you can find him at Paradox Kid on Twitter, not on Wrestle Talk TV, but you can find all his stuff on Wrestle Talk TV. He writes loads of stuff specifically about TNA, which if you are a TNA fan, which you should be, He writes some of the best guides to those shows and gives his opinions every week. I'd also like to thank Chelsea Spollen of shouldersup.net. Thank you very much for your time, man.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Yeah, it's been good. For those of you who don't realize, we actually recorded two shows, so we've been talking now for 2 hours solid about pro wrestling, and what a better way to spend on your Sunday. So thank you very much for listening to us on the WrestleTalk TV podcast network, which you can find on iTunes, SoundCloud, and all your favorite podcast providers. We hope you've enjoyed the show. You can follow me at Sheriff Lone Star. Please do follow us. Please give us reviews on iTunes. Help our algorithms and help us get to be bigger shows, because we've had a big boost in listenership recently. So we're greatly appreciative of that. Thank you for more people listening to us. We really appreciate it. We do enjoy doing these shows. But it's nice that someone else agrees with us and listens to what we're doing. So thank you very much for your time for listening today. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye.